Good morning. Thank you. Good morning and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. My name is Sandra Barrett, and on behalf of University College of Syracuse University, I want to welcome you to today's edition of the Roundtable, and also to remind you that we have just three programs left this season, so I hope you will not miss any of them. Absolutely. You never know what you're going to hear and how it's going to come into play. I think my timing, I will say, was impeccable, or you could say it was a little bit off with last week's program. You know that the subject of last week's program, the Onondaga County Water Authority, has been in the news a little bit. But now you have the background to assess some of what you've been reading about and think about what to do about it. Next week, though, Mayor Stephanie Miner will be our speaker and talk about what is going on now in the city and what her plans are, and I'm sure she'll be looking forward to your thoughtful questions. So that will be great. Then we go on to hydrofracking, and then we end up with a discussion on Seneca Falls and government change. I don't want to put any loaded questions in there. Anyway, this morning, as you know, Congressman Dan Maffei is here with us, and to introduce him is TMR member and WCNY member, Dr. David Smith of Upstate. I say that because I saw his little promo on WCNY the other night. Thank you, Dr.
Thank you. Well, good morning. All right. Well, great to be here and certainly to listen to our congressman. I had the privilege of introducing him this morning. I would first say that I'd introduce him as a friend and colleague. Dan, as we all know, is the congressman of the 25th District here in New York. And many would say, well, he's a freshman. But if you walk the halls of Washington, which many of us do, and I was looking to see my dean there as well from the College of Health Professions, you will find out very quickly that Dan Maffei is not considered a freshman. I think they actually did give him the key to the washroom right away because of his incredible experience with both Senator Patrick Moynihan as well as Bill Bradley. He is someone who's been in House Ways and Means. He knows his way around, but at the same time, he's never lost touch with his community. I think we all know he's from Syracuse, graduated from Nottingham, went to Syracuse as well as to Syracuse University as well as Brown and Harvard. Has an incredible pedigree, but more importantly about Dan, and I've had the opportunity to visit with him both formally and informally, and it's great to have the opportunity when you can sit down with Dan informally and get his real sense of things, his thought process, his inquisitiveness around whether it's healthcare or anything else. He's also a great stalwart, both in the halls of Congress as well as in New York, and is an incredible fighter for the things that we need. I say all of that because I really don't have to, but I really believe all those things. And I know we're going to talk about health care reform, and several of you have asked me already this morning, well, how's it going to impact you? Well, I would first suggest that it's really about how does it impact all of us, not just individuals. The problem in the debate is quickly everyone got to the individual focus, which isn't inappropriate, but in the global sense, this has made an incredible difference in this country, a country and one of the only ones in the world that had almost 40 million people who were uninsured. And the fact that we're beginning to make a dent in that, I think, is significant. Also, the word prevention occurred in this bill, which is also remarkable and something that I certainly support wholeheartedly. So while I look and watch what's going to happen individually, including to Upstate, I know that Dan has had a keen eye during all of that for many, many of his constituents and yet kept an eye on the most important thing, which is individuals. And I would say the one thing we all have in common here today, at the end of the day, is that we're all ultimately going to be patients. You're going to be lying there on that stretcher someday, whether you like it or not, wearing that designer gown that doesn't cover everything and looking up into those fluorescent lights go by, but you really don't want to worry about certain things. And the reality is in this country right now is one out of about every seven adults is uninsured during their lifetime. You'd play the lottery if those were the odds. In the lottery, and that's certainly not the odds you would want in the area of healthcare and healthcare coverage. I will just say one more thing before I introduce Dan, and I was with a conference, I was telling him about it in Washington 3 weeks ago, with a presidents of International Group of Academic Health Centers. In other words, not only the hospitals, but the colleges of medicine, health professions, nursing, and all the rest, from almost every stop in the world. And the international group that was there, including from China, Taiwan, Japan, Germany, Chile, Italy, Great Britain, and India, all at that one point stood up, congratulated the country, and said, welcome to the 20th century. With that, I am going to introduce our Congressman Dan Maffei and my good friend.
I'll do that. Okay, hello. Thank you. Thank you all. Glad to be back at TMR. This is a very, very home-like experience for me because, of course, I live on the next hill, actually the next valley, I guess. I live right near Pebble Hill School. I did go to Nottingham High School, like two kinds of people, okay? Good. Thank you. Okay. Very, very glad to be back in my old neighborhood and see a lot of the people. And also, of course, when I came back to Syracuse, I never actually joined. I know a lot of people were trying to get me to join, but I knew I couldn't really attend as much as I'd like. But I did come to a lot of Thursday morning roundtables and learned an awful lot about some of the intricacies of what's going on in Central New York and around the world. So I'm very, very glad to be here. I'm not going to talk actually too long because I really think that, particularly with this group, it's so important to get to your questions and comments about healthcare reform. But I will talk a little bit about the process and why I think so many people have been turned off by the process. And then a little bit about what it was like to try to make this decision and how I came to the conclusion that I did, that it was vitally important to pass and for me to support this fundamental healthcare reform bill. The process, I don't think anybody would like to defend. And in fact, I kind of wish I had a broader podium here whenever I face anybody and talk to them about how this went through. You know, in my generation, when I was a kid, we had something called Schoolhouse Rock, which was, you know, when you watch Saturday morning cartoons, they would, like, sneak in these little educational things every now and then to try to get us to learn something between our super friends and our Hong Kong phooey. And the Schoolhouse Rock had this cartoon about a bill, how a bill becomes a law. I'm just a bill. You've probably seen it. It's on the internet. You can get it for your kids today, too. And it's got this cartoon Bill who sings, I'm just a bill. Yes, I'm only a bill, and I'm sitting here on Capitol Hill. And then he talks about how he goes through this whole process. And he goes, first he gets introduced by a congressman. Somebody had this idea, I think, involving a traffic light. And then he gets put in committee, and he gets stuck in committee for a while. It's a little suspense in this little cartoon. But he gets out of committee, and he gets passed by the House, and then he goes to the Senate, and he gets passed by the Senate, and then he goes to the President, and there's a lot of drama here because if he gets vetoed, he has to start all over again. But, of course, he's not vetoed. At the end of it, he signed it, and then, you know, he signed your bill. You're now a law. And he goes, oh, yeah, that's great. Then we go through school, and somewhere, hopefully in high school, but maybe in college, but we learn a little bit more about the process. We learn that the House can, has different rules than the Senate. Senate has something called a filibuster. You know, you can stop bills even if you don't have a majority of people, but you can basically talk them to death, and you learn how this happened in the Civil Rights Movement. You learn that often the House will pass a bill, and the Senate will pass a bill on the same topic, very different from each other. It won't be like one just goes to the other, and they have a conference committee, and they get together, and they negotiate, kind of almost like two countries would negotiate, and then they bring those back. And that the president sometimes threatens a veto and then can get in the room that way and negotiate before there ever comes to his desk, things like that. It's a little more complicated. Then we get to the reality, and particularly with this health care bill, and I was at the Maxwell School yesterday talking about this. I think it astounded even these students of policy and government how absolutely complex this system was. So what happened here, I'll try to do it really fast. What happened was a bill was introduced. Actually, the president ran on this. He came up with an idea. He said, well, I want a bill introduced. But he didn't want to introduce it himself because he remembered what happened in 1993 with Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton. So he didn't introduce it himself. He had some of the House leaders introduce the bill. So the House leaders introduced the bill. That bill was referred to not one, not two, three committees. So three committees marked up the bill. The three committees marked up the bill, and each one of them came up with separate bills. So people kept asking me, Dan, did you read the bill? Did you read the bill? I'm like, which bill? H.R. 3200. Which H.R. 3200? There are four of them. Then those three bills were basically, you know, kind of new, you know, the leadership looked at them, everybody looked at them, and they were sort of scrapped, but most of them were rewritten, you know, parts of it were rewritten into another bill that then was passed through the Rules Committee. The Rules Committee, what's that? Well, the Rules Committee is a separate committee that sort of considers all legislation, and that's how legislation actually gets on the floor. So the Rules Committee does this. They pass out a separate bill, And then there's all this give and take and back and forth to try to come up with enough votes to pass that bill. And it seems like this huge dramatic thing. And lo and behold, the bill is passed. History is made by 5 votes. Everybody cheers in the auditorium, right? It's over. Of course not. It's not even close to over yet, because then the Senate's got to consider it. But the Senate doesn't want to consider the House bill at all. They essentially throw that away. Actually, they already had thrown it away and did their own bill. Totally different. And that was marked up by 2 committees, 2 totally different committees, though. One with Ted Kennedy, the one that Ted Kennedy was in charge of. It ended up being Dodd because he was so sick, but Kennedy was obviously a big force there. And the other by the Senate Finance Committee, which tried to do it in a bipartisan way. And then you had Max Baucus negotiating with himself for 4 months into a mirror. Then you came out with this totally different thing out of both of those committees, and you had to put them together. So Reid essentially said, well, we'll scrap that, take pieces of it, and put it together in a totally separate bill. Then, of course, though, there was being filibustered. But it wasn't filibustered like we saw in, you know, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, where Mr. Smith... No. There was no talking. It was just threats, all these threats. Oh, but so you have to get 60 votes. You have to get 60 votes. So all the negotiating back and forth, let's buy Nebraska. And finally, you get 60 votes... So you pass the bill, but you're not done yet because that's just the 60 votes. You have to still talk about it for 48 hours. It's, you know, Christmas Eve. Santa Claus gets a vote. And you end up passing the bill barely on Christmas Eve in the Senate. Great. So now we have a Senate bill and a House bill, but they look very, very different. Some aspects the same, very different. So now you're going to have a conference committee, right? Wrong. Instead of that, you try to have a conference committee, and you sort of start the preliminary stuff, but it takes a lot longer. And then lo and behold, Ted Kennedy passed away and his special election elected a Republican in Massachusetts. So now not only does this totally change the political landscape and everybody's scared, and et cetera, but it now means, guess what, you don't have 60 votes under any circumstances. So you can't do the 60-vote thing. Well, then what do? Well, easy. You just have the House pass the Senate bill. No way. I mean, you know, the House passed a bill that's in the Senate. I will tell you this. It would have been extremely difficult for us to pass the Senate bill, and for good reasons. The Senate bill would have seriously disadvantaged our hospitals in New York State. The Senate bill would have, I believe, eventually in the near term, taxed health care policies for middle-class people in high-cost states like New York. It had all sorts of reasons to basically poison pills, in my view, anyway. So the House, and I certainly wasn't the only one. There were, you know, maybe 150 Democrats who felt that way in the House. So the Senate bill wasn't just going to pass. So, okay, well, we have to come up with some way to change it. Well, we can't change it because then there'd be a filibuster. But wait a minute. There's this reconciliation rule. What does that mean? Well, you can pass a bill in the Senate and they can't filibuster it if it saves money. So we'll try to do that. We'll come up with a bill that saves money. Oh, but you can't do all these health care things in order to save money. But what you can do is you can pass the Senate bill and then you can make changes to it that will all save money and will fix some of those problems. So that's what we'll do. Okay, good. We'll do that, right? Oh, but wait a minute. You've got to have the Senate bill become law first. Well, if the Senate bill becomes law, then how do we know that the reconciliation is going to be passed? By now, everybody knows we can't trust the Senate. Well, maybe if the Senate passes the reconciliation bill first, then we'll all know. Great. Nope, sorry, you can't do that. Only the House can do the reconciliation bill first. So instead, you ended up getting 50-something senators to sign a piece of paper promising they would send it, and you get the president saying, you know, that he'll do this or he won't implement that if it happens. So you finally get, and then you're going to do a rule that says you're just going to pass them all at once and you're going to deem the Senate bill passed. No, everybody objects to that. So finally, you do get somewhere where the House passes the Senate bill, the president signs the Senate bill, House has already passed reconciliation at the same time as it passed the Senate bill. That then goes to the Senate. The Senate passes it. You have to do all this, though, in the last week of March, because if the president should sign the reconciliation bill in April, you would have 2 separate health care systems in 2 separate months. All the accounting would be screwed up. But we managed to do it. He signs the thing. It's over. Oh, my God, it's over. Now, I forgot to add that they added the student loan provision on at the last minute. But whatever it is, you can tell how this process, regardless of what you might think of the product, seems... You know, I mean, sausage making is pretty compared to this. So I can understand why Americans at this point are at the very least confused and at the most kind of disgusted with this. And you hear all sorts of strange arguments that make a lot of sense. Like, well, how could you use reconciliation to get around the Senate rules? To get around the Senate rules that require that you have 60 votes in order to pass anything? I mean, that's not in the Constitution. Things like senators who are... One single senator is holding up bills that have clear, broad support, in essence, becoming more powerful than the President of the United States. The President can veto, but 2/3 can override. Senators can veto seemingly even if 2/3 do want to override, or at least you have to go through a lot of trouble for that. So each, you know, you have all these criticisms of the process, but in the end of the day, it is the process. It was set by the democratic system, small d democratic. And at the end of the day, you do have a piece of legislation that was negotiated and talked about and all different parts of the country. And even a lot of the Republican ideas are in it. In fact, almost all the Republican ideas are in it. Some not as much as the Republicans would like, but almost all the Republican ideas are at least in this bill. But it didn't get any bipartisan support, and so everybody goes, well, that must mean it's a problem. But then if you look at our history, you look at how Social Security were passed and Medicare were passed and other kinds of things that are now broadly popular, you encounter the same kind of stuff. And then, of course, both sides now, I think, have used a lot of hyperbole. This bill is not the be-all and end-all of health care reform. President Obama, no matter how much he wants to, will not be the last major president that does health care reform. In fact, I believe this shouldn't even be the last major health bill that he works on. It's really a start, a foundation, if you will. It's not building the house, it's building the foundation. In terms of health care reform, it really is only the very bare beginnings. In terms of health insurance reform, it's a significant bill. But in terms of health care reform, we've really just started to scratch the surface of how we need to change our health system to be more efficient and to help more patients. I do think it was a necessary first step. What the other side says, you know, and there are very legitimate reasons to be concerned or opposed to this bill. I think that smart people can disagree. But what you heard from the other side, particularly in the last couple of weeks, was it's Armageddon. It's socialism. Socialism? Well, President Nixon had a proposal on the table in the early 70s that had a lot more government involvement than this. If this is socialism, what's Medicare? I mean, if this is socialism, what's Social Security? It's so far from socialism, you know, you can criticize it, but it's not socialism under any circumstances. We even heard on the floor that it was a totalitarian bill, totalitarianism, unconstitutional. That seems to be an easy word for them to say. So you get this really, and then, of course, you had the screaming. You know, you had these Tea Party people, and let me say that we have Tea Party people in Central New York, and I've never seen the kind of tactics from them that I saw in Washington. So I also think that we can be wrong when we either stereotype about Tea Party people, but certainly the protests in Washington that we saw, there's really no escaping. The only thing that it reminded anybody of, including John Lewis, was the Civil Rights Movement and people screaming because they were concerned that their children would have to go to school with an 8-year-old girl who happened to be African American. Very bizarre and out of proportion with a debate about this kind of policy. What it is, as I said, I think it's a foundation. And what made me make the final conclusion that I absolutely not only had to support it, but had to strongly support it and help get others to as well, was what we're comparing it to, the status quo. What would happen if we did nothing? Now, a lot of people can say, and I think it's fair to make the argument, that, well, we should have done better. Maybe if we just negotiated longer, if we'd started over, all that other stuff. If I believe that, then maybe I would have come to a different conclusion. I don't believe that was possible. I believe that if we did not pass this, when we passed it, we would have closed the door politically to any kind of health care reform for at least 10 years. It took me a while to come to that conclusion, and the President of the United States made the argument himself to me. But I just don't see how you get around that message, given how difficult it was, would have really slammed that door shut, and we wouldn't have been able to make any changes. So the people who really criticize this system and say, oh, it's going to cost so much, or how can we afford to pay for all those uninsured people, or how can we get the doctors? Well, those are things we need to think about and certainly need to look to even making improvements in the bill. But it's not that we're comparing this to some ideal that was never going to happen. We have to compare it to the status quo. And maybe we don't know whether we can afford everything in this bill, but we know we cannot afford the status quo. Healthcare costs for businesses have more than doubled since the year 2000, and there's no reason why they're not going to continue on that trend if we hadn't changed it. Hospitals are becoming almost impossible to function because of the number of uninsured that show up. What are they supposed to do, not treat them? I mean, we could do that. As a society, we could do that. That is an alternative that maybe some of the people would argue we should do. But if you say we can't afford to cover the uninsured, well, we certainly can't afford to treat the uninsured when they have even more serious problems and come to emergency rooms. But that's what we're doing now. So the way that I thought about this proposal was not in terms of some ideal, but was in terms of what we have now. And when I ran for Congress, I basically talked about the healthcare system, and I said that we absolutely needed to change. Too many people were not having covered. Too many people who are covered were not getting the healthcare that they need. And it was costing a lot, and there were all sorts of, I've talked about my wife. She hates when I do this, but I talked about my wife, and she had a small kidney infection. It was simple to treat. We went to, I think we went to Krauss Urgent Care or whatever, and the insurance company dogged us for months and months and months, actually before we were married, dogged her, put a private investigator. I mean, I don't know if you've met Abby. She's not the most physically threatening person. Put a private investigator on her, you know, and why? Why? Well, was, you know, you can't go to urgent care to have this done. You have to go to immediate care. I mean, literally, there's just that one word. You know, so eventually, of course, they paid for it because it was a very legitimate expense. That happens to every single one of us. So, you know, people say, well, this isn't really healthcare reform, it's insurance reform. Well, we needed insurance reform. And certainly we needed to start on healthcare reform. So, look, I'm not claiming here that this is a panacea, that this is the end all, but it is a beginning. And it's a beginning to something that I believe we absolutely needed to do, not just, by the way, for the country, certainly not just for the uninsured, but for ourselves here in Central New York. Our number one employer is David Smith's operation, Upstate Medical Center, our number one single employer. Our number one employing industry is healthcare. From one end of my district to the other, by the way, I go to the border with Rochester. Even though I don't have Strong or Rochester General in my district, they are a huge employer. Not to mention Welch Allyn, all of the device manufacturers that we have, Bristol-Myers Squibb. Healthcare is one of our major industries here in Central New York. If the healthcare system goes broke, goes, you know, it's too much, if we can't afford it, if people stop, you know, can't get insurance at all, if only the very wealthy can get pharmaceuticals and get treatment, our economy is going to be in big trouble. And then, of course, you do go back to the United States and look at the trends. I don't have any graph here, but I'm gonna try to get one. It's radio anyways, how this is simulcast. But the graph that shows costs for most industrialized countries, healthcare cost inflation, is going up. It's going up maybe at roughly 35 degrees, still a little bit too high. Our curve is like 75 to 80 degrees, just skyrocketing. By the way, hard to imagine, particularly with the CBO's estimates that say that this will save $1.3 billion in the 10 years, subsequent 10 years from 2020 on, that could ever get worse. And that's the problem. We need to make it better. Those other industrialized countries, I'm not saying they're perfect either, but Britain particularly has about the same life expectancy as us and spends about half as much per person on health care. Some of the other industrialized countries spend a little bit more, but they have much better life expectancies. Our health care inflation under the current system is simply not sustainable. My final word is a quote from my favorite philosopher, Yogi Berra. Yogi Berra once said, "If you see a fork in the road, take it." Now, he claimed that he said that because he lived on a cul-de-sac, so it really didn't matter which direction you go. By the way, I live on a cul-de-sac. Pebble Hill Road is actually a cul-de-sac. It doesn't really matter which turn, you know, I go, well, make your next right turn. And then we missed the right turn. Okay, make the next one after that. How's that possible? But anyway, but actually what I suspect the deeper meaning behind if you see a fork in the road, take it, is that it's better to take action than inaction. The difficulty with where we were and where it seemed like the entire political system was it was paralysis, and we were never going to make a change. What if this is the wrong thing? What if we're wrong about it? Certainly we're going to be wrong about pieces of it. No, nothing. The healthcare system alone is so complicated that it's impossible for any piece of legislation to address it to be perfect. But if we're wrong, then at least we learn something, we can correct it. But if we never do anything, we know that we're on that path to a cliff. We just have no choice at all. I believe this was the right thing to do. I actually think we made the right turn at the fork in the road. But whether we did or not, we needed to take action. We needed to do change. And if we couldn't do change on healthcare, we would not have been able to do change on energy, an argument, by the way, that the Secretary of Energy made to me himself. Difficult to argue with somebody with a Nobel Prize. We're not going to be able to make change in our economy, not going to be able to make change in our school system, which desperately needs reform. We're not going to be able to make any other kinds of changes. And that's why it was just so vitally important that this bill move forward, that we enact it into law, and now we continue the process of trying to improve not only our healthcare system, but our economy and so many other things that we know we can do. Thank you.
Thank you. I think we have a few questions in the back.
What would you say goal one is as far as making improvements in the present law?
Well, the thing that I think is the thing that I would criticize the most about the present law is a lot of the vagaries that are left up to the administration. For instance, businesses often ask me, well, how do I know that I have a qualified health insurance plan? And I even have businesses that have been concerned that their health insurance plan may not qualify as an quote-unquote affordable plan. That's the language in the legislation. And at the same time, that it might hit the now extraordinarily high high Cadillac plan tax, which doesn't include, you know, dental and eye care, et cetera. So to hit that Cadillac tax now, you really would have to be a Cadillac plan. So you know that's not both. You both can't have one that's not affordable and is so generous that it hits the Cadillac plan. I can't give a straight answer to that. Well, you're a politician. Of course you can't give a straight answer. No. I can't give a straight answer because it actually is determined by regulations in the Health and Human Services. So one of the things I would like to see is maybe make sure that we know what those things are, that they're far easier to understand. I do think the bill is overly complicated, and I think a lot of it could be simplified, at least simplify the back and forth. And probably the number one thing is I think that we need to work harder on getting a sort of a co-insurance model for healthcare, no matter what it is. Instead of people paying high premiums, they should pay a stake in what their health care is, provided it's not truly preventative care. One of the great things about this bill is that it does provide, make sure insurance companies provide preventative care for everybody free of charge. So the kind of health care that we want people to get, because it does save money, it'll encourage getting. But, you know, all sorts of other things, you know, there should be some skin in the game for the patient. And that's important. And then last, I still believe that we needed a public option. I really do. I don't see why. In my district, I have people who completely don't trust the government. They completely don't trust the government. And I have people, probably even a slightly larger group, who completely don't trust private insurance. Well, if you don't trust the government at all, you're already kind of out of luck because of Medicare. You're eventually going to have Medicare. And nobody wants to stand up and say, well, we should get rid of Medicare. But if you completely don't trust the private sector, you're also totally out of luck because the only insurance available to you, if you're not poor or indigent or disabled and not elderly or senior, will be private insurance. Regulated far better than it is now, but still private insurance. So those are the changes I'd make. Thank you for the question.
Hi, Dan. My question really goes to the time phasing. There are a lot of things that really stretch out to a lot of years. I was wondering how you arrived at those type of benchmarks or time frames to have different pieces of it take action.
Good question, Ed, as always. Mostly by necessity. There are certain things that simply couldn't be implemented faster. For instance, the insurance exchange simply needed, you know, you needed a couple of years to be able to get it up and running. You know, I've seen this with really good programs. I believe the Cash for Clunkers program was a really good program, but it had to be implemented very quickly, and there was all sorts of issues with it because of that. So in terms of getting people insured under the exchange with the choices they need, that takes a little bit longer. Doing a change such as this without time to adjust is really difficult. In some ways, the healthcare system is like a very large sailboat. It can be turned, but if you turn it too fast, it'll actually capsize. So, you know, you want to make some of the regulations phase in over time. It seemed to everybody that pre-existing conditions needed to be covered, and in fact, they will be covered. But we started with children. So children will no longer be denied insurance within six months. Children will no longer be denied insurance because of a pre-existing condition. You know, difficult to do that with adults right away, to do the whole system, so that takes a couple of years to phase in. A lot of things do take effect right away. The small business tax credits take effect right away. And by the way, I was out at a small business in my district the other day. They had no idea about this. They'd heard so many bad things about the bill. The bill's bad for small business. They get on the IRS website. They do a little research. Lo and behold, this business, it employs 15 people in manufacturing, qualifies for about $20,000 a year for help paying for their health insurance. So not only is it not penalizing them, they already provided decent health insurance. Now suddenly they're going to get $20,000 to help them compete. So there's a lot of that stuff actually takes effect immediately. So we basically made the decisions based on necessity. I will say this. Everything in the bill takes effect within the next 5 years. I mean, this is not a people, you know, I'd like it to take effect by November for obvious reasons. But in terms of you know, policies and how quickly a policy can take effect, this is actually very, very immediate. There's been a lot of criticism that, oh, all the taxes don't phase in for years and years, and yet we'll be stuck with them for life. Some of that criticism, I think, is valid. I do think there are some budgetary gimmicks in this bill, but not anywhere near what there are in most bills, frankly, healthcare or not healthcare. And there are, you know, and there's reasons to believe that, you know, most of the revenue raisers are, one, going to be less needed in the future. The Congressional Budget Office's score, which says that the bill saves 1.3, by the way, I mean, that's, nobody believes it. Well, the bill spends tons of money, big deficits, et cetera. Well, the healthcare system already spends tons of money and leads to big deficits. Again, what are you comparing it to? So we look at the next 10 years. The CBO, which is not only nonpartisan, it's actually very conservative. When they estimated the cost of the Part D, Medicare Part D, which was a Republican program, but it was an important program to get seniors some help with drug coverage, they estimated it being far more expensive than it ended up being, in part because of the donut hole and other things that held down the cost, but those things were in the bill originally. So I believe actually the bill will end up saving more money, maybe not in the short run, but in the longer run when we're really more worried about it than it does now. Incidentally, the Part D, if you fall into the donut hole, that's another one of those things that's phased in, $250 immediately of relief, but eventually, within the next 5 years, the donut hole does close completely. Another good question. There's been a lot of talk that this has huge cuts for Medicare in it. In fact, traditional Medicare will not be affected at all, at least not in terms of the patient benefits. There are a number of provisions in the bill that cut down on Medicare abuse, make sure that providers can't do Medicare abuse. There actually are sham providers or that will... you know, ask, you basically put in false claims and then move from one location to another. It works on those. There is a restructuring somewhat of Medicare Advantage. So traditional Medicare, pretty much untouched. Medicare Advantage, there is a restructuring in. And it mainly is a reduction in payments to insurance companies to incentivize them to provide Medicare Advantage. Now, if the insurance companies are getting less money to provide these Medicare Advantage plans, then it stands to reason that they might raise the price, right? So that's where the, oh, my Medicare is going to get more expensive comes from. But the difficulty is that Medicare Advantage right now costs more per patient than traditional Medicare. And the whole point of it was to take the same amount of benefits and to structure them in such a way that a Medicare recipient could have a choice. And that makes sense. I would not want to get rid of Medicare Advantage. But to subsidize that and to say, well, you have a choice, but guess what? We're going to make it a lot better. We're going to put more taxpayer money in if you get Medicare Advantage than regular Medicare. So it does try to correct that. In instances, though, where the Medicare Advantage programs are more efficient, are much closer to traditional Medicare in their costs, this actually provides more help. It basically says we're not going to penalize those Medicare plans. And lo and behold, those are the kind of Medicare Advantage plans we have in upstate New York. MVP Silver Sneakers, I don't know if that's so prevalent here. It's more prevalent in the Rochester area. Excellus has some plans. There's another major plan. I just forget the name. But these plans actually are far closer to the basic Medicare average, and therefore they won't be penalized as much. So it's possible that there might be some Medicare Advantage changes that would affect seniors, but in this region it's pretty unlikely. By the way, those changes were in that reconciliation bill. One of the reasons why I was so concerned about the Senate bill alone, but we were able to get that fixed. It was a Senator Schumer provision we were able to make sure stayed intact, and so proud of that.
Dan, there are still 10 to 12 million workers uncovered by this bill. These workers do the most menial of tasks, by and large. They happen to be undocumented aliens. And can you talk a little bit about health care for the undocumented and how to bring them out of the shadows, if you will, and into the mainstream? Because they're a part of our lives.
I don't think I have to tell anybody that the politics of covering undocumented workers were far too much for the Obama administration or anyone else to take on. In fact, one of the arguments against this bill constantly was that it did cover undocumented workers. In fact, you are correct. It does not. It does not at all. In fact, there's several points in the bill. It explicitly says that that undocumented immigrants will not be covered. And, you know, so people might say, well, that's they're not documented. They don't pay into the system. That's good. Well, the problem is that if an undocumented person gets sick, somehow, Dr. Smith can attest to, somehow those germs don't know they're undocumented. They, you know, they tend to spread to people who are citizens and documented immigrants. How can that be? I mean, you know, so do we get little microscopic INS folks to go chase those undocumented germs? Not really practical. So it is a mistake not to provide health care. It also is inhuman, frankly, not to provide health care for people, anybody. I don't care who they are. And so, you know, you've got to provide health care. So what's going to happen essentially is the same thing with them that currently happens with poor Americans who are uninsured is they will end up going to the emergency room. And this will still continue to place a burden on the system. But you asked what to do about it. I actually don't think there's much we can do politically until and unless we pass comprehensive immigration reform, because there simply is not the political support in this, even in this district, to cover undocumented workers right now. But if we can get an immigration, I believe my district, I mean, I certainly have extremes on both sides, but I believe that my district, there is a true consensus that we need a path to citizenship. We need to make sure that industries that currently simply do not have a skilled workforce in the United States are able to get guest workers, but that there's a way for people to become citizens, particularly students that graduate from Syracuse University. We help them get these great educations, and we immediately say, great, now go back to China and run an economy, help run an economy that's competing with us. And they want to stay here. So and for all sorts of reasons, we need to pass immigration reform that, you know, really does enforce, you know, when an employer such as a builder might be employing undocumented immigrants that do undermine U.S. jobs, that really enforces that, enforces other kinds of immigration laws, but allows a more reasonable way for us to bring in people, because I think most of us are families of immigrants. If we could do that, then I think as part of that, we would be able to make sure that most immigrants are covered, because, you know, we'd be able to figure out how most immigrants could be documented. Short of that, I don't have any easy answer there, but you're right about your point.
Was there any thought given to the coverage of basic dental services? I mean, people walk around with rotting teeth that can cause heart attacks in this country, and since podiatry is included in Medicare, and I assume it's included in the new insurance rules, but somehow the mouth is separate from everything else? I mean...
Yes. Again, you know, germs come from the mouth, and... you know, they somehow don't understand that they're supposed to stay in the mouth. They're dental germs, you know. It's a dentist that protects them, not a MD doctor. Don't they understand that? And they somehow spread to other parts of the body. Funny how that happens. I agree with the premise of your question. I agree with the premise of your question. Yes, it was considered, and it was considered to be too expensive this time. That doesn't mean that it wouldn't have been the right thing to do, but we didn't. In fact, one of my strongest objection to the Senate bill was that it would have this tax on so-called Cadillac plans be a total amount of what the plan provided, and even if it provided full dental, that would be included. I don't believe that dental is Cadillac. One of the things I'm very proud of, and actually I worked hard to get this changed, was that both dental and eye care would no longer be considered as part of a health care plan in terms of the tax, so that you could have, if you had an employer generous enough to offer dental and eye care, which we do here in Central New York. By the way, most other places don't have that kind of generosity. But our employers are actually very, very generous for the most part. Then so at least it doesn't penalize dental. But I'm afraid to say it doesn't do much either. For that reason, the American Dental Association did not support the bill. They did not. I don't think they opposed it either. I think they were sort of staying on the sidelines. But we need to do more for dental. It does do one thing though that I think will help a lot, and that is it. Very much increases and enhances funding for community health services. often which provide dental to people who really can't afford it. And I think that'll have a huge impact, not only, by the way, in the dental area, but on all sorts of other kinds of things. It acknowledges that that some people will still remain uncovered, and that people with coverage may be able to get a better bang for their buck going to community health centers.
Good morning, Dan. I'd like to ask you about reproductive health care, but I'll set that aside. There was a lot of discussion about pre-existing conditions and insurance, and about 5 years adults will be able to change jobs. Has anybody in the budget department taken a look at how many people are in stagnant jobs and not helping the economy because they cannot change jobs because of a pre-existing health condition?
The answer to that is I don't know. I'll have to find out. I think it'd be valuable to look at that. I hadn't thought of that. That actually is an advantage, that with more portability of health insurance, and that does take effect immediately, that you would be able to, there will be, more people moving jobs. Anything that enhances the movement of goods or services or employment is generally good for the economy, leads to economic growth. So, but I don't know for sure on that. One thing about the pre-existing condition regulations that I think people should understand about New York in particularly, and in fact some of the other insurance things that are in this bill, community rating, making sure that you have portability of health insurance, making sure that there are no lifetime or yearly limits. A lot of people have said that these kind of things will raise premiums. Well, there is an argument that they might raise premiums if it weren't for the fact that many more people were coming into the private insurance market. One of the things, the way this bill does make sure the premiums will be lowered, is it brings a lot more people into the private insurance market. So although on the one hand it's regulating insurance companies more, it's also bringing a lot more people in. Now, in other places that may lead to premiums that go down slightly or stay roughly the same. New York, however, will actually have a bigger advantage. And the reason is because our state laws already do a lot of these regulatory things that the federal laws will now do. However, we actually compete with these other states, and it's even theoretically possible businesses move to other states. Oh, we can't afford insurance in New York, but we can afford it in other states. So now, though, but we already have that. So we already have the upward pressure on insurance rates. But now we'll have a lot more people coming into the insurance market, the private insurance market in New York. So what this bill adds is a downward pressure on insurance rates that wasn't there before. It also makes, at the end of the day, puts a rule that any insurance plan, any private insurance plan, has to provide 85% of what you pay in has to be spent on health care. So there is sort of that ceiling there. The argument that this will raise premiums, and I'm not saying that premiums couldn't possibly go up, but they certainly will go up much less than they would have under the status quo.
I'd like to thank you publicly for your thoughtful consideration and ultimate positive vote on health care reform. I'm wondering, though, as we go through the implementation of the bill, how is Congress or is Congress going to be watching to ensure that health inequalities and disparities that we already have in our system aren't going to be continued?
Yes. Certainly if Congress does not, it is not fulfilling its responsibility to the American people. It's absolutely essential that Congress watch the implementation. As I mentioned earlier, one of the things that I think the bill is most vulnerable on is leaving a lot of these things vague. What is an affordable insurance plan? How exactly will this exchange be implemented? The pre-existing conditions, I think we all believe that those laws will certainly help people. For instance, currently in some parts of the country, domestic violence can be considered a pre-existing condition, even pregnancy. And those things will all be eliminated by statute, but will they be enforced? I sit on the Judiciary Committee, and so for me, a lot of this stuff will be how these regulations are enforced, whether it's reasonable enforcement, whether it's uniform enforcement. So I certainly think that there's going to have to be a lot of congressional oversight. And the other reason is that I think there may need to be some statutory adjustments made as well, While I believe if this bill had failed to pass, health care would have been impossible to have done anything on over the next 10 years, and maybe more politically. Because it did, that doesn't preclude, the opposite is not true. I think we can, in fact, make changes, and hopefully positive changes, to the bill. So both in terms of making sure that the government does what it's supposed to do in this and doesn't overstep or underenforce, but also in terms of making sure that, you know, that we can make changes and adjustments. By the way, Medicare did as well. When Medicare was passed, it was really just a foundation of what Medicare eventually became.
Dan, the dynamics of the voting for health care, as you mentioned in the beginning, there were a number of pieces of Republican suggestions that got incorporated in the bill. But the reality was that the Republicans voted as a block against the bill in both the Senate and the House. And the reason was that they, perhaps unstated, that they wanted to bring down the president. Now, what do you see this as far as the future of other legislation?
Well, I really, believe it or not, in politics, I really try never to attribute motives to anybody. So I can't tell you why the Republicans voted that way. I do think, whether I'd use exactly those terms or not, I do think certainly political strategy was a large part of the reason why you got this block, particularly the block voting, the way it was. And just to be fair, Democrats did, mostly attempted to do and failed, but did do this when George Bush was president and the Republicans had the majority. So, you know, it's part of how a two-party system, for better or worse, works. But, you know, I certainly think that had this bill failed, it would have helped bring down the president. When I talked to the, I guess maybe the best way to answer it is just relate my conversation with the president when he called me. Now, I was satisfied enough once we had the changes that were made in the reconciliation bill, and we had a pretty credible guarantee that those changes would be made. I had talked to a lot of constituents, and I was quite sure I was going to support the legislation. So by the time the president called, I said, you know, hello, Mr. President. I'm assuming you're calling to discuss your NCAA bracket. And he said, no, Dan, I'm not. He said, you know, I want to talk to you about health care reform. I said, of course. And anyway, you know, he talked about basically, and I think even further convinced me, that this was our chance. This was not a choice between this health care reform and some other nebulous health care reform, but a choice between this health care reform and living with the status quo for at least another decade or two, which I didn't think we could ever afford. So I told the president, I said, well, look, Mr. President, not only am I going to support you, but I'm going to try to find others to support you, and I'm going to strongly support you. Because at the end of the day, you know, we only have one president, and not only do we need you to succeed, the American people need you to succeed, and I truly believe that. So in that sense, I agree with you. I think if this had not succeeded, the president would not have succeeded, and his administration would have been severely weakened.
Sometimes when bills like this get passed, things get attached to them during the political process that help them get passed. Are we going to have any surprises in the next year or so?
Yes. Well, I will tell you that my provision to deem Renze Anawaku healthy unfortunately did not get included in the final bill. Look, any legislation this complex, I'm not comfortable saying that I can absolutely guarantee you that there will be nothing in there that you don't already know about or even that I don't know about. But in terms of the special interest provisions, I do, or the so-called special interest provisions, I do believe that the scrutiny that both the Republicans and the media have placed on the bill make it extraordinarily unlikely that in a year they're going to find something, or in a few months they're going to find something that hasn't already been exploited. In fact, there, you know, all sorts of things that were interpreted in the bill aren't really in it. Somebody finds four or five words and thinks they know what they mean. I was asked a lot during this debate, and I think this is relevant here, I was asked a lot during this debate, did you read the bill? Did you read this bill? Did you read that bill? Did you read the entire bill? I understand what is in this legislation. That does not mean that I sub-vocalize the bill from start to finish. HR, whatever it is, from start to finish. And the reason is because I actually did do that with the first health bill, mainly so I could say I read it. And it was almost, not completely, but almost a completely unproductive experience. And the reason is because this is a very complex system, and bills are written, it reminds me of computer language. I don't know what they do now, C++, whatever it's called. But when I was a kid, it was Pascal or Fortran or whatever. And I took computer classes down at Central Tech with Larry Page. And, you know, you could, these programming languages used English words and sometimes English sentences. But that didn't mean that if you just knew English, you would know whatever they did. It's the same thing with legislation. And a complex system is going to require very complex legislation in order to change. A lot of people said, well, I just don't like 1,200 pages. We shouldn't need 1,200 pages to change healthcare. Well, it's kind of like going to your surgeon. You know, I really don't think you need a four-hour procedure to fix my heart. You should be able to, it should be much simpler. I don't trust this. It's too complicated. I don't understand it. You should do it in 15 minutes. They're going to say, find another doctor. The healthcare system is complex. These bills are complex. And the whole legislative problem, I mean, you know, legislation is in some ways like a computer program. It's coding. Everything is, you know, refers to something else, and there's cross-references and references. But that said, I do think the nonpartisan staff that tells us what's in these bills and helps us make sure we know exactly what it is very, very ethical, and I don't believe there's anything in here that's going to surprise us. Now, there's some stuff in here we already know about. However, it's interesting, the reconciliation bill actually took out the Nebraska stuff. It took out some of the other stuff. Some stuff like the so-called Louisiana purchase was a disaster aid. You know, I'm sorry, but that's not, you know, maybe that's a special thing, but I don't know if that's one thing that any of us would individually really want to oppose if we knew what it was. And then there were things in there, like I said, I mean, does treating more efficient Medicare Advantage programs in upstate New York, there's some in other places too, but we're certainly one of those areas where there's more of them, is that a special interest provision? I'm not sure about that. Those things are in there, but I'm glad they were. I fought for fairer treatment of New York in this bill.
I kind of waited till the end until someone else broke the health care questions. Number one, I have two questions. How can we stop the politicking on our phone system when we come home from work every night and have 2 and 3 messages from last night? It wasn't you, but it was somebody else. And I'd like to get my name off that list, and I'm sure others would. Number two, I don't always believe everything that comes through the Internet. In fact, I think the Internet does some damage to good things that are being done. But yesterday something came through called the Cap and Trade Bill, H.R. 2454, that was passed. It's going to require all of us to have a license on our homes that they were inspected. Is this something that's true, or is this a false?
Yeah. No, that's not true, at least not under the bill that the House already considered. I don't know. I could tell you a lot of examples that were in the healthcare bill, the death panels. There were never any death panels in this bill. Actually, that was a provision that simply allowed physicians to get some reimbursement if they talked to patients about end of life decisions. That's what that was. That turned into death panels. There were a number of other things in the healthcare bill that are just simply not true. People are going to be sent to jail. Because the IRS, there's going to be a penalty if you don't get health care at all, and if you don't pay your taxes, you go to jail, right? Well, in fact, this bill specifically says that not having health insurance, you'll never go to jail because of that. There was this number made up, about 16,500 IRS employees, totally made up. I'll have to check on that specific provision, and I'll ask my staff to do that. I'm sure it's some misinterpretation of, you know, basically saying that, you know, homes should be weatherized, and we'll give you a credit if you do, and that turns into, you know, if you don't get your home inspected, we're going to throw you in jail, because if you don't get your home inspected, then you won't get that tax credit, and therefore you may have to pay higher taxes, and if you don't pay your taxes, you go to jail. So, you know, that's how those things get started. So thank you for not believing everything you read on the Internet. I actually think that a large part of the problem with this process and all the misinformation, not only about this but about many, many other things, is because our society has not caught up with the technology. You can say anything you want. You can say anything you want in the newspaper. You can say anything you want on television. Now you can say anything you want on the internet. But we all sort of know who to trust when we pick up a piece of paper. You know, when somebody hands you those papers, the end of the world is coming, and, you know, whatever. We don't read that like, oh, my God, the end of the world is coming. I just read it on a piece of paper. It's printed on a piece of paper. No, we know, okay, that's not, but if I read the Post Standard, okay, that has more credibility. It does, Dan. Right, so we know that now. We're more mature. Same thing with when we watch television. We know what's you know, but internet, we don't have that. Oh, my God, it was on the internet. I read this on the internet. We don't have that yet. So I think that's exactly how you want to read the internet. People can say anything they want, not necessarily attribute it. You brought up something else at the beginning of your question. The phone calls. Well, certainly with us, you can, you know, call our office, and we can take you off of all of our lists. But there is no do not call list for political calls. But I have to tell you, there's for a good reason. Same with do not mail list, et cetera. When running for office, you try to reach out to people. And everybody says, well, I need to hear from you. I need to see you. I need to know what you think. And then what happens? You get into the campaigns. And people are so sick of those commercials. If I see one more political commercial, I'm going to freak out. I can't stand those commercials. And why the only thing they cover this time of year is the politics on TV. You know, I'm tired of politics. I really don't like politics at all. So, okay, well, you don't want to see politics on TV. Okay, well, what will it do? Well, we'll mail you all this junk mail. I can't stand all this mail that I get. You know, why am I sending all this junk mail? Phone calls. I don't want messages left on my machine. It's my machine. This is my privacy. Okay, so then, you know, Dan Maffei, I actually do this every year. Go door to door. Don't come near my door. I don't want to see it. Well, look, we live in a democracy. It's messy, but it is a democracy. There has to be ways to reach people. I'm not saying that the phone calls are the best way, and that's why we'll take you off our list. Certainly we'll take you off our list. But to then sort of say, well, I want to be, you know, somebody can cut themselves off from the world, and, you know, maybe we can find some happy medium or something where you can say, well, I don't want phone calls, but I'm okay with me. I mean, I don't know. But frankly, we all, and certainly if you're here at TMR, I think you agree, we all have a responsibility to sort of be informed. We have to allow some avenues to inform us, and even if we disagree with a phone message or something, you know. So if it's on your machine, if you know, I apologize, but it is part of living in our society.
Congressman Maffei, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us today.